Session number 28743.
Hugh Richardson, Reel 6. When you weren't transporting singers, what were your daily duties?
My daily duties was keeping a strict eye on my craft round Naples Bay, because the Italians are notorious for stealing anything that moves. And I actually did lose one of my craft. It disappeared, and I had to tell London that I had lost a harbour craft, which wasn't a pleasant duty, and they weren't very pleased, but there was nothing I could do about it. I couldn't put armed guards on all the craft I had scattered around the little ports in Naples Bay. So it disappeared, and I had to alter my records of the number of craft I had. But it was interesting to be responsible for them and check them that they were reasonably fit for action if they were required, because we did mount a lot of them in the beachhead at Anzio, which was one of the famous beachheads of the war when the Allies went behind the German lines and landed at Anzio. It was a miniature an invasion, and our harbour craft were used for that, and they were used for the invasion of Sicily eventually, but I had come home by then. But the harbour craft division was quite important, mostly the tank landing craft and craft like that. And the responsibility of the directors of harbour craft was just to be able to supply, when the military and the navy people wanted them, harbour craft of all types, particularly the tank landing craft and the tugs and the barges. And they were obviously had to be available and kept strictly available for duty, which they were. I had an interesting colleague, an American captain. They tried to have a different nationality in each of the divisions, and he was an American who owned a shipping line in America, and his name was Jacob Martin, captain. And I found that when Chubb, I called him, when Chubb and I were in the office, we shared a desk. He was sitting opposite me, and he used to say, "Have a cigarette, Hugh," and he would toss 200 Camel cigarettes across the desk, and that was his idea of giving me a cigarette. He was a great chap, and I liked him enormously. But when he took me to his officer's mess, I then became a limey. It was a definite atmosphere, I found, that when Americans are together, they keep together, and they do not like outsiders. And I was accepted with an ill grace. I was accepted because Chubb was a captain in the army, and was perfectly all right, as I say, when he was in the office with me, but not when he was in the officer's mess. And when we went on one interesting outing, he took me to a house which is pretty famous, really. It lies in a causeway off the coast of Naples, and it belonged to Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the spiritualist. And he took me one night because there was a party of American officers going across to this house, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, I think, had died by that time. The house was not being occupied by his family, and they went across to this house, across this causeway. We went in a jeep, I remember, and we went across this causeway which joined the house to the mainland, and we went into this large gloomy house, and gloomy it was. I could well understand that he was a spiritualist. The atmosphere was very strong, very gloomy, but the Americans soon livened it up, and they performed the sacrilege of dancing jitterbug dancing in his drawing room, which I thought was rather going over the top, but that was the kind of thing they loved doing. And as I say, I didn't really enjoy being with a number of Americans at that time, because they always seemed to, you became rather an outsider if you were English or Scottish. And but it's, it was a strange feeling to be in that house. It was quite marked atmosphere. And the months went by, and I stayed in Italy, and it was a strange feeling because the fighting was still going on up north of Italy, and Monte Cassino was bombed. And I remember Chubb was one of these chaps who wanted to see everything and take pictures of it if possible, like the Americans do. And he said, "Come, Hugh, we'll go up and see the ruins of Monte Cassino." I said, "Do you think that's wise?" I said, "They've only just moved out of it." So, but he said, "Oh, we will go up, we'll see what it's like." We went up in the jeep, and I can remember being fairly terrified because the guide that was showing us around what remained of the mountain and the monastery, that they bombed the monastery, the guide said, "Please keep to the small narrow path which is marked by flags. Don't step off the path, whatever you do," because it was heavily mined by both sides. Both sides had laid mines, and they didn't really know where they were, as you can imagine. And I was not happy at viewing Monte Cassino. Very historic, obviously, to see it, but the devastation was incredible. And this beautiful monastery was bombed, and all that we did was create foxholes for the snipers. More of our troops were killed by snipers out of the ruins of the monastery than any other part of the action. And a lot of our troops were killed falling off down the precipitous cliffs round the monastery in the dark. They actually mounted an assault on Monte Cassino at night, and some of the poor fellows never got there. And the wastage of life around that. But it was such a fantastic, you could see practically the whole of Italy from the top of it. You know, but they had to seize it, they had to get it, because as long as it remained in the Nazi hands, it dominated the countryside all round it. And it stopped traffic of the army getting up Italy, so they had to do it. They had to bomb the monastery. I remember it created an outrage all around the world when we did it, because they considered it was dreadful to do that. And but it had to be done. One could see that when you went there, you could see that it was a vantage point, and it dominated the whole countryside around it. But I was very thankful when I came back from Monte Cassino, back to the safety of Naples.
Did you have a sense of how the war was progressing when you were in Naples and working?
Yes, you did. You realized that the war in the Mediterranean, we were nearly at a point where we had to give up. No question. If we had not retained Malta, it would have been very, very, very near we'd have lost the Mediterranean. And if we hadn't bombed Rommel's supply lines from southern France, we would not have won Alamein. That's my humble opinion. Because might have done, but it would have been very much harder, and it might have been problematical whether we would have succeeded. And if he'd got to the Suez Canal, the Mediterranean would have been lost, and history will tell us that it wasn't lost, and a large part of that is due to Malta.
How did you pass your time in Naples when you weren't at work?
I had a strange experience. I was very keen when I was young on ballroom dancing. And I used to go to Sorrento to join my brother-in-law, naturally, when he was having control of this hotel. And I was there when a contingent of army nurses arrived there on rest and leave. And they came to Sorrento, obviously, to this place to have a relief from their arduous. They had followed the army right up through Italy, and one can only imagine what they had to deal with. And I met a young captain in the Queen Alexandra Nursing Yeomanry, that was their title, and they were army personnel, of course, and they wore uniform, and she was an army captain. And it was strange to have a feminine person with three pips on their shoulders. But I met her in the hotel, and we got talking, and we found that we both loved ballroom dancing. And she said, "Have you had any experience of ballroom dancing?" And I said, "Yes, I have." I said, "I've danced semi-professionally with a professional dancer who was the East of Scotland professional champion." "Oh," she said, "you have?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Well, can we go dancing?" I said, "Certainly." So we went to a ballroom, which is a lovely ballroom on the top of Naples, and I found that she was nearly as good as the professional. And this was very good. I enjoyed that enormously, and she was there for a month. And we had an excellent time, not only dancing, but the Hotel Cochimillo, which was a hotel in Sorrento, had a private beach, and she swam like an otter. And I don't swim. She used to go out and swim in the sea, and we thoroughly enjoyed that month's leave that she had. She came back to the UK, and that was the end of that. But it was very enjoyable while it lasted. But it was strange. The Italians thought it was strange. The only thing she regretted was she couldn't wear pretty frocks because she was an army captain and she had to wear a uniform. But that didn't matter. We enjoyed the ballroom dancing because she was fairly expert. That's a strange aside, isn't it?
What sort of involvement with Italian culture did you have?
I had quite an involvement with it. I used to be invited to some of the Italian villas, which are fabulous. The villas on the coast have got such wonderful views from them that they're breathtaking. And some of the Italian families were keen to have British personnel as guests. And I went to some of these houses and villas. And it struck me very forcibly that those Italian families, the young ladies are strictly chaperoned, and you never are allowed to be with young Italian ladies without the chaperone. But otherwise, it was very enjoyable. I mean, they have a wonderful sense of entertainment, obviously. And I can only express a view that the young Italian females, or ladies, I should call them, are very beautiful when they're young, but the constant intake of pasta and olive oil in their food makes them less than beautiful when they're older. That's an ungentlemanly thing to say, but it's an aside. As you can imagine from the varied things which I have said, the year in Italy passed, and it came to the end of 1945. The war was nearly over, and I eventually was coming home. And I flew in a Dakota, which had been used for the parachute jumps, and the seating was primitive, to say the least of it. You sat on a metal bench which ran along the fuselage, and it was very uncomfortable. It took us 9 hours to fly from Naples to Blackbush Aerodrome in England, and I arrived on Christmas Eve, 1945. And that was nearly the end of my war effort. I was sent for to the Ministry of War Transport, I was officially, I ceased to become a government official. But I could have done, they requested me to stay on, sign my name and become an established civil servant, which was a remarkable offer, but it meant foreign service again. And strangely enough, it would have been Yugoslavia, and I did not wish to have any more foreign service. So I returned to greyhound racing at the end of 1945 and took up again. I walked into my office at Reading Stadium. It was just the same as I'd left it, and I sat in the same chair and I carried on, and I tried to forget about the war. Not successfully, but I didn't give it too much memory, but of late I've begun to remember all of, or a lot of the things that happened, because I feel that it's important for people to hear and listen to some of the experiences that the British Army and Navy and Air Force and Merchant Navy particularly, if I may say so, some of the experiences they had during the war, the Second World War. And I must say this, because of the number of dear friends I lost at sea, the Merchant Navy has never received the praise that it did for running or taking part in the convoys. We lost an enormous number of men killed and lost, and it was a service that was has been referred to, although I'm not being personal about this, as they were unsung heroes. When one thinks of the conditions that they served under, if I may dwell on the Merchant Navy for this short time, when one thinks that we were listed as non-combatants, and that's an irony, if you like, we were not armed, machine guns on the bridge was about the maximum. We were targets for the dive bombers and every other kind of attack. Some of the experiences that these merchant seamen went through are horrendous. If one itemizes people on duty in the engine room, if the ship was torpedoed, the danger from burst pipes containing live steam was dreadful. If they didn't drown, because they couldn't get to the escape ladders, they were scalded by live steam and literally burnt alive, if you like, or so badly burnt that they wouldn't recover. That's just one facet of their experience at sea. The other experiences like this: if they were torpedoed and they took to the lifeboats, I've known people spend 14, 16 days in an open sea in a lifeboat, which is a terrible experience, and it particularly in off the coast of Africa, where it can be scalding hot and they're burnt alive by the sun. You can take the privation that they suffered in the lifeboats. You can take the lifeboats when they were launched, were often machine gunned by the Nazi gunners from their planes, which is an outrageous thing to do. But that was the plight of so many of the merchant seamen who lost their lives. And there were tremendous losses suffered in the convoys in the Atlantic and in the Mediterranean. The whole Mediterranean war was tremendous for aerial attack on the ships. The enemy airfields were within minutes of flying time in Sicily and southern Italy, and could be over your ship in a matter of minutes, or they could be over Malta in a matter of minutes. And the whole impact of the Luftwaffe in the Mediterranean on shipping, Royal Navy and Merchant Navy, was tremendous, and the losses were incredible. They were never properly understood or even acknowledged. I don't think they have been acknowledged properly. And I would say I do feel that the Merchant Navy should have had more, not praise, not acclamation or anything like that, but thankfulness that they did a job which was tremendously dangerous and could suffer an enormous privation in it doing it, and they never received the credit for doing that. They were listed as non-combatants, which is the supreme irony. They should have had armed ships, they should have armament on board to protect themselves. The Navy did their best to protect the merchant ship, they were marvellous, but they had the guns on board and they could do it, but they did do it. And the best flag that I ever see in the world is the White Ensign, the Royal Navy. Because so many times they were responsible for saving us, and acting as they did, they were marvellous. And the Merchant Navy can always be very grateful to them for they treated the convoys like sheep, shepherding the sheep. And I haven't forgotten that small destroyer racing at full speed to tackle a pocket battleship to protect a convoy so that the sheep could scatter. And there we are, that's what they used to do as a matter of course. That was their duty and they did it. But I hope I haven't sounded too fulsome in my praise of the Merchant Navy, but it's a subject very dear to my heart.
Just to finish off, what made you interested in wire radio operation in the first place?
When I was 17 and I left school, I toyed with the idea of joining the Merchant Navy, and that was before the war, obviously. This was a peacetime aim, and I went to a college in Colwyn Bay in Wales and took a course of wireless, as it was called, wireless telegraphy in those days. And it was a residential college, and I stayed there for a few weeks, and I learnt the Morse code, obviously, which is the basic thing, and operation of a Morse key, and tried to get the speed up. And I wasn't enamoured with the idea of, at that time, of going to sea, and I thought better of it, and I went back home, left the college and went back home. But when the war came, I thought to myself, why not resuscitate this knowledge, which I had a certain knowledge of using Morse, and I thought I would go and join the Merchant Navy if I could get the requisite qualification. So I went to a college in London and I trained to get the speed up, which is essential, and I eventually acquired the necessary speed, which is 25 words a minute in Morse, sending and receiving, and that part of it. And I eventually got a certificate of efficiency in that field, and I applied to the Marconi Company, and they said, yes, if you've got the necessary certificate that states you're qualified, we can offer you a position. And that's how I came to be in the Merchant Navy.
Could you just explain a bit more in detail about how the process of sending and receiving worked?
Yes, well, in those days you had a manual key, and you operated the key, and you had to get up a speed of sending a message at a speed of 25 words a minute. And you also had to be able to read that speed, because at sea you kept watch on a wavelength of 600 metres, and you were on watch alone, and you had to be capable of reading Morse and taking any signals from the land stations like Land's End and Rugby, places they had the transmitters. And you had to be qualified, and you had to have you had to have the confidence to do it, because when I took my first messages, as I explained, from Land's End, it was vitally important for the ship that I didn't make a complete mess of it, and I didn't get the message. I had to get that message, and I got it, fortunately for me, and the rest of the ship's company, because there was a U-boat lurking around there, and it was a question of getting into Bermuda. That's the kind of example that you had to deal with at sea. And you also had to, when you got a message in code, you had to learn the codes that you deciphered the message from. There were special books, and it was a secret code, of course, five letter in each word, and it was quite a thing that you had to acquire to be a radio officer. But that's how I that's why I initially joined the Merchant Navy, because I had that qualification.
And how did the Aldous lamps work?
Oh yes, Aldous lamp is a metal box on which has got plates inside it, there's a bright light behind the plates, and you operate a handle on the side and send Morse code. And as the plates swivel, they send the light out in Morse code, and that is the way you communicate from ship to ship in a convoy. That's called the Aldous lamp, and it was equipment that was used all the time. As I've said about the signal I took from Warspite, you've got to know what you're doing. You've got to get it and get it right. And sending it is... And I had an interesting experience with an Aldous lamp. When I left Dakar, I was out in Dakar with the ministry for a period. I haven't touched on that. I was coming home in a convoy as a passenger. And the bridge sent a message down to me, come to the bridge. And I thought, well, they must be short-handed. I'll go and help them out. But it wasn't like that. I went up to the bridge and they said, "Are you Mr. Hugh J. Richardson?" I said, "Yes." "Government official in Dakar?" "Yes." "There's a ship in the convoy who wants to speak to you. Can I send to the radio officer and get him to take your message and send it to the ship in the convoy?" So the second officer was on duty on the bridge on watch. I said, "No, that won't be necessary. I'll do it myself." He said, "You cannot do it yourself. How can you possibly do that? You're a government official. They don't train you to do all the slam signalling." I said, "No, but I've been one of you." "Oh," he said, "you have." I said, "Yes, I know how to do it." I said, "You tell me which ship it is and I'll soon do it." So they told me the ship. I called it up, and it was a captain whom I had entertained in Dakar at dinner many times, and he said, "Hugh," he said, "I never realized that you were actually doing it yourself." He said, "I signaled the ship because I wanted to pass you a message. I knew you were on board, but I didn't realize that you would send the reply back to me." I said, "Well, I'm quite capable of doing that." He was quite amazed. And it was quite fun, because the second officer, before I told him that I had been in the Merchant Navy and had done this, he was quite flabbergasted. He said, "You can't do that." He said, "This is a wartime convoy. We can't have people, passengers, sending messages to other ships." I was frightened. The Commodore that might have interfered and told us off for doing a private message on a wartime convoy, but he didn't. There was no flashing from the Commodore ship, but I was quite glad about that. Yes, that was quite funny.
Could you still remember your Morse code?
Yes, I can remember it now. I can read Morse when it comes on the thing. It's never left me. I don't know that I could read it at 25 words a minute. It's pretty fast, the stuff they use on from time to time. Yes, I can still, it still goes in and I can translate that. Yes. It's a thing that stays with you.